February 9th, 1983, policy task committee meeting will come to order, please. Let the minutes show the presence of the committee members, Mr. Gall, Mrs. Cato, Mr. Miller, Mr. Tripp, and May Tisher. I would like to welcome all of those of you who are here as observers and as those who came to testify. And I'd like to remind those who are going to be testifying, please state their full name, and if you have an organization that you're representing, please state that. The legislation that we are about to review in this meeting is House Bill 117, an act relating to sexual abuse of a minor, House Bill 127, an act to increase the punishment for sexual assault in the first degree, and House Bill 128, an act raising the penalties for promoting child prostitution. I'd like to make you all aware that we are set up for teleconference, and I believe that there's some folks in Anchorage that would like to testify. And I'm not sure how we're going to be doing this, but we don't have any folks. They're going to want to testify at 1:30 on any one of these three bills or one bill. Any one of the three. So they'll be linked into us about 1:30. I'd like to ask staff whether or not they're going to be able to hear this testimony up until that time. They are going to. So any testimony that has been brought before us between now and 1:30 will be heard in other areas. The list of witnesses to testify include, and we'll be taking up one bill at a time so that we don't get confused here. There's a couple of witnesses for each one of these bills. And prior to that, I'd like to ask Mr. Palmer, who is staff to the HESS committee, to explain a couple of things that he has for us, and I'll just let him have the floor to begin with, and then we'll proceed with the testimony.
There's a one-page summary of three bills on one page. I'll just let that stand. There's also a chart with a lot of little square boxes and some, that's right underneath the summary. I think it's on the outside of your folder, maybe right on the top. And that chart indicates the current sentencing. The presumptive sentences are in parentheses, and minimums and maximums are listed in each of the columns. The proposed changes on all three of these bills I've written on in red, so you can see what the sentences are and what the offenses are and how it might change. So we can refer to that as you go through it if you want. On House Bill 117, primarily what it proposes to do is to create a first degree and a second degree offense for sexual abuse of a minor, and it breaks the differentiation between first and second degree on age at between 13 years and 16 years or under 13 years. Right now, sexual abuse of a minor 16 years or under is a Class C felony, and the proposal is to make a Class B felony for first degree for offenses against any minor under 13 years of age. So you're going from one offense for any minor under 16 years to a first degree or a second degree based on whether or not the minor is 13 years and younger or 13 years to 16 years. There are no fiscal notes for any of these, so we can't move any of these out of committee without a fiscal note. The fiscal notes are in the works, and that's the most I know about at this point.
Thank you, David. Representative Lindauer, would you like to come forth and testify for, oops, wait a minute, Kessinger, I believe. Which one take 117 first? Sam, would you care to explain your bill to us?
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chairman. I think David did a good job on the initial introduction of the bill. What we're seeking to do, what I would like you to consider doing, is to change the concept of child abuse, which is presently a Class C felony. child abuse as a Class C felony has a maximum of 5 years. And I'm asking you to change it from a Class C felony to a Class B felony, which has a maximum of 10 years. So I'm asking you just to increase the severity of child abuse. The remaining part of the bill deals with the traditional statutory rape, and as a practical matter, that is remaining the same. The reason why I would encourage you to consider raising child abuse to a more serious crime is because of the tenderness of the age. The age of 13, or who is under 13 years of age. Now, what we've got to be careful of, though, in participating with the Crime Commission, we actually had testimony from families who had experienced this, so that we could look at the pros and the cons. The con is when you have a husband who is employed in a community and who is a breadwinner, who in all appearances participates in our society, but who has obvious psychological problems. That can be a real problem to remove him from the setting of the family home. That is a very sensitive and delicate issue. So if we make child abuse from a Class C to a Class B, the important thing is, on if we look at the sentencing, is that for a first-time offense, there is no mandatory minimum. It is up to 10 years. You don't get into presumptive sentences until you deal with the second or the third offense. I have done this because I have observed our court system. In most cases, the area of child abuse is not an interfamily problem. It is that third party who is committing this serious offense against children under the ages of 13. And it is this person that we wish to direct our attention to. It is this person I wish to direct my attention to. Can I answer any questions that you might have about the bill? What I noticed from the judges were that you could have a child abuse situation and the man could, there was a lot of probation, a lot of minimum jail, a lot of, gosh, this is like a psychological problem, or this is like maybe a man who exposes himself, you know, let's kind of put him on probation and this is too bad. And not enough attention was given to the victim. And it is my intent to have you consider giving more respect to the victim. And I believe this is a message to the court system to give more respect to the victim, who has experienced something at a very sensitive age that can imprint her life. And that was the policy behind the bill.
Mr. Cahill.
Yes.
Representative, you said that it was not an interfamily problem. However, we do hear and read quite frequently of cases of incest, not only of a father, but possibly stepfather, various things like this. I guess my question is, how high is that incidence, and does it fall under a different category?
Well, you're correct on your point. I think that what we want to get at are those third parties, those unrelated people who take advantage of the youth. That is who we want to get at. That is who we want to reach. But as a practical matter, you do have a serious incest problem, and it is true, it exists, and it is prevalent. I do not know the statistic, only that you are correct, and it does exist. That's why if we're going to raise this from a Class C to a Class B, it is very important to me that when I read in the area of presumptive sentences, that there is no presumptive sentence. That is, there is no mandatory minimum that a judge has to give for a first offender. I could, because of the incestuous problem, I could not support this if there was a mandatory minimum for a first offender. That's very practical, Representative Cato.
For the record, I'd like to show that Mr. Davis and Mr. Kopanen are present. Are there any more questions of Mr. Pettinger? Mr. Miller?
Representative Pettinger, maybe I'm missing something here, but why, under the old setup, it was a Class C felony for any minor under 16, and under this, it's a Class B for anyone under 13, but it's still a Class C for anyone between 13 and 16. How come the breakdown?
Well, the way that it is proposed now to where we're making it a Class C, reading that language, I read that as kind of the traditional statutory rape statute. With a person who is under 16 years of age, but 13 years of age or older. I think age is an important factor. 13 years or older, you begin to, it doesn't sound very nice, but there begins to be a concept of consent. And that's why I'm separating these two out. 13 or less, it's a very sensitive age. 13 or older, sometimes you are in a situation where two people are consenting, and that's why I've distinguished between them.
Are there other questions for Mr. Pessinger? Thank you very much, Sam. Do you have any other comments that you'd like to make?
Well, only that, of course, it's a very sensitive area, and I respect Representative Cato's question, very important. I think due regard has to be given for the incest question, and that's why, fortunately, there's no mandatory minimum on this. And thank you very much, Madam Chairman.
I have a question about that, Sam, and I maybe ought to clarify that a little bit in terms that the layperson can understand. Are you saying that incest, as situation regards to your bill, should not receive the severity at a first offense, or are you saying that it is a different circumstances and needs to be addressed in a different fashion?
When we're dealing with incest, I do look at it as a different or a spatial situation where we want the judge to have discretion to frame a sentence based on the fact that he is dealing with a person who may be the breadwinner of the family. And the judge is going to have to balance that delicate situation of what to do with this breadwinner and the damage that will be done on the family by having him stay with the family, having him have counseling, having him remain as a breadwinner, or having him be incarcerated. It becomes very awkward when we say that a judge must incarcerate a little girl's father. That may cause more psychological damage. That's why we have judges, and that's why I think in this incestuous area, the judge should have discretion, should have broad discretion, and the penalty section does allow that discretion.
Is it your impression then that consideration of the father has a greater bearing on decision making than consideration of the child who has received that abuse? Is that a different circumstance in the eyes of the law, for example, than regular rape?
Well, we are seeing...
Rape is regular.
Right. We are seeing a shift of emphasis to victims' rights. And I believe we want to encourage that shift of emphasis to victims. So we should measure this from the impact, pardon me, that it would have, for example, on a daughter. We should measure it from her impact. And we must not look at it so much what it will do to the father, but what it does to the daughter in relation to the father. So I look at things now from victims' rights, and I measure things from the victim. But that little girl's relationship with her daughter can be a factor that must be considered in the overall disposition of the matter.
Incest is not addressed in your bill at all?
No. Child abuse is child abuse.
Okay. I wanted to be sure that you...
Child abuse is child abuse. The judge would have the discretion to sentence a father who had abused his child under this bill. He has the discretion to do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Are there questions or more discussion on this bill? Is there any... Yes, Mr.
Sometimes prosecutors are reluctant to proceed to prosecute a case because they may feel that in a given situation a heavier penalty may lead the jury to let an obviously guilty defendant off. There are various other factors of that type. Have we requested a position paper or position papers from the Department of Law and the Department of Public Safety in these regards?
Dave,
in regard
to these?
Mr. Davis, and then we'll ask for your testimony.
Okay, just following along, do we have some kind of position paper from Health and Social Services?
No.
No.
No, we asked for one, and it's on the way.
Gail, would you like to come forward and take some testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I did have a position on all of the bills that I understood the committee was going to consider this afternoon, 127 and 128 as well. Would you prefer me to address them one at a time?
I would prefer one at a time so we don't get confused.
Okay.
And would you please state your full name and so forth, because you're not signed in, and I've got to get it down.
I must have signed the wrong sheet.
I'm sorry.
Something. My name is Gail Horetsky. The last name is spelled H-O-R-E-T-S-K-I. I'm with the Department of Law Criminal Division, and I appear before you today with some dubious credentials. I was prosecutor for 4.5 years in the city of Anchorage, and for the last year and a half of that period, the only types of cases I prosecuted were sexual assault and child sexual abuse. So I know more about these cases than any of you ever wants to know, and I know more than I wanted to know, in fact. I have had the chance, because of that experience, to see firsthand some of the, in my opinion, holes in the current laws, and I'd be certainly willing to address those if there are any questions about it. I want to alert the committee, first off, before I discuss the merits of the specific bill, that the Department of Law is working right now at the request of the governor on a comprehensive revision of the sexual assault statutes dealing with child sexual abuse. What we plan to do, and this is just in the drafting stages, it has not yet been finalized, is take out, perhaps physically, but if not physically, then at least by incorporation, reference by incorporation, all of the provisions of the current law that deal with child sexual abuse, try to put them in one place in the code and try to graft some coherent scheme for the way child offenses are dealt with. Under the current code, for example, sexual penetration with a minor under the age of 13 is an A felony, carries a presumptive 8-year term, and sexual penetration with a child between the ages of 13 and 16, as the Representative Pettinger commented, is currently a C felony, carries a maximum of 5 years imprisonment. So you can have a situation where you have a 40-year-old man having sexual intercourse, abusing sisters, for example, and one of them is 12, and he's looking at a presumptive 8, and one of them is 13 and a half, and you're looking at no mandatory minimum or presumptive term, and a max of 5. And in my opinion, the discrepancy there is too great. There are also areas of conduct, very serious interfamilial conduct, which is not covered at all under our current law. It's very, very disturbing conduct. And hopefully our proposal will address those areas. Another problem is that sexual contact with a child between the ages of 13 and 16, most commonly touching the breasts of a girl, touching the genitals of a young boy, is only contributing. It's an A misdemeanor. The most the person can get is a year in jail, and that's the maximum. You have to find them to be the worst type of offender to even get that sentence. And we've had situations where we've had men abusing boys serially, 3, 4, 6, 7 boys that we find out about. And if the boys happen to be over the age of 13, or the abuse continues beyond the point where they turn 13, all you've got is a Class A misdemeanor. In my opinion, that's much too low. It doesn't reflect the seriousness of the conduct, the abhorrence that society feels for that kind of taking advantage of children of that age. With that sort of preliminary introduction, with Madam Chairman's permission, I will address specifically House Bill 117. the Department of Law is in favor of this bill, generally speaking, so far as it goes. The proposal that we have drawn up in our comprehensive revision does raise sexual abuse of a minor to a B felony. I agree that the penalties for sexual abuse under the current law are too low, especially in relationship to sexual assault in the first degree, which is what penetration is with a child under 13. The discrepancy there is just too great. There's no reason why it should be that way. It doesn't fit into a comprehensive framework. I have a, excuse me, I have a cold in addition to everything else. I have two problems actually with this bill. I don't believe it goes far enough in terms of addressing the problems under the current law. And I also believe that Section 442, Sexual Abuse in the Second Degree, which keeps the current penalty for what the representative called statutory rape, which is a good way to think of it, keeps it the same. I have a problem with that. What we're trying to do here is lump apples and oranges, and I think that's where our problem comes in. This, the current law and this provision, which would continue the current law, punishes equally a 17-year-old boy or an 18-year-old boy who has sexual intercourse with his 15-year-old girlfriend, and you might have a senior and a sophomore you're talking about. Consensual sexual activity between those two people is a Class C felony, and that boy is liable for 5 years in prison. Now, anything you read nowadays talks about the fact that young children, young adults, are becoming sexually active at an earlier age. As a personal opinion, I don't think that's a good development. I don't think they're really mature enough to handle it at 14 or 15. But I don't think that those kids are committing felony crimes. I mean, they may have enough problems, and you certainly want to address the problem in terms of family counseling or education in the school, but I don't see that prosecuting a young boy for a felony offense is the answer to that particular problem. And I certainly know firsthand as a prosecutor that those cases are virtually impossible to prove, because the girl comes in and says, but I love him. You have the mother in here, I want him put away. And the girl won't testify, the boy is scared to death. It's an unfortunate situation that, in my opinion, doesn't belong in the criminal law. Now that's a policy decision, certainly the committee is free to disagree with me. That's one situation. Then the other situation, which I feel very strongly about, is your statutory rape situation, where you have a 35 or 40-year-old man who is having sexual intercourse with a young girl. Now, in fact, that might be, quote, consensual intercourse. If it was forcible rape, it's first degree, and you're looking at the mandatory age. So we're only talking about, again, quote, consensual activity. The reason I say quote there is because I wonder, really, whether a 13-year-old girl is emotionally mature enough to make a decision to live with or sleep with an older man. Certainly it happens, but I don't think it's a situation to be encouraged, and I think in that case it's appropriate for the criminal law to step in and say this behavior in our society is considered inappropriate, and we feel that we can impose sanctions on the older person, the actor. I say man because it usually is, but of course our statutes are sex neutral. Could be a woman, a young boy. It's appropriate in those circumstances to punish that behavior by criminal penalties, and traditionally there's always been a statutory rape law in the state of Alaska. I would suggest, just by way of throwing out a suggestion, and again this is something we're going to address in our proposal to the governor, that sexual abuse of a minor be raised to a B felony across the board. In other words, don't keep the other section as a C felony, but that you graft in another requirement, an additional phrase of some sort, that in addition to saying the actor must be 16 years of age or older and the victim must be 13 to 16 in that block, that you graft in another requirement that the actor be at least 3 years, for example, or 4 years, or whatever you want to pick, older than the victim, so that you eliminate your 15, 17-year-old felony situation when what you've got is kids fumbling around in the back of your car. Basically, those are my comments on that particular bill. As I say, I would like to address the others when that's appropriate. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Are there questions of the committee? Thank you. That was a good explanation. Thank you very much, Gail. Gail, would you be able to stay?
Yes,
I appreciate that very much. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify for 117? We understand now that folks in Anchorage are ready for testimony, and we should call them up and let them testify on this particular bill, House Bill 117. And we'll need to have identifying names.
This time, Linda, we have no one.
False alarm. Would they stay online and let us know when there is someone here that would like to testify, and we'll continue on with our testimony.
Okay, thank you, Linda.
We're still considering 117, House 117. How about committee? Do you have any questions? Comments, any recommendations that we might talk on while we're waiting for the Anchorage people to show up?
Yeah, Gail.
Mr. Gall. Gail, could you come back again? I want to, we have a question or two for you. Thank you.
Thank you. I was wondering if you had particular specific recommendations in terms of ages and so forth as to how you would break down this problem that you discussed. Differentiating between the, and it's not just 17, it could be the 16-year-old boy and his 15-and-a-half-year-old girlfriend, or vice versa, for that matter. No, I was just wondering if you'd had some specific guidelines that you think would be
helpful. Unfortunately, I didn't bring it with me, but I can refer you to the Controlled Substances Bill that passed last term. The number that escapes me right now. I could get a copy of the language, but that bill deals with furnishing of controlled substances to minors, and in addition to setting limits as to the age, I believe it's 19 in the drug bill as opposed to 18, there is also additional language that the defendant, if he furnishes controlled substance, whatever schedule, to a minor who is, I believe it says, 3 or more years younger than him, then that's a Class C felony or whatever it is. That way you eliminate, for example, the problem of charging under the drug bill, a 17-year-old with a felony for giving some heroin to an 18-year-old. You require, number one, that it's younger, and number two, that there's a certain age difference. So you also eliminate the problem of an 18 and a 17-year-old being in a pickup together and they're sharing a substance and one's not guilty of anything and the other's guilty of a felony. The overall focus was an attempt to punish the people, to deter the behavior of the people who deserve to be deterred or punished, but not to unfairly penalize people who are basically in the same situation but happen to be chronologically a little different. And I would suggest language along those lines. A person being 16 years of age or older and 3 or more years older than the victim who engages in sexual penetration with the person.
Thank you.
Please.
By way of background, it's coincidence, but
today I received a report that there are 65 reported cases of child abuse, not sexual abuse, currently being processed on Prince of Wales Island. I'm told that there are 65 cases of child abuse that have been reported on Prince of Wales Island over the last year. And to respond to this problem, there is one half-time social worker who's dispatched out of Ketchikan. What I'm wondering, I have two questions. Number one, what is the breakdown between sexual abuse within the household and child abuse in general? In other words, what percentage would you say involves sexual activity?
Let me just ask a question for clarification, sir. Did you say child abuse, not necessarily sexual?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. In that situation, I would believe that.
Yeah, I'm just talking about domestic violence, not, and this may have been a confusion resulting in the last series of questions with Representative Pessinger. Clearly, we're talking about sexual abuse here, and no, I'm just saying in general, and I was wondering what part of that might be expected to involve sexual abuse.
Sexual abuse of minors is epidemic in Alaska. I absolutely and sincerely believe that. I have been to national conferences, and it's kind of funny because you sit down and have coffee with people from Des Moines or New York or wherever, and they say, boy, it's an epidemic in Des Moines. Or, you know. And so what I think is that, in fact, this kind of behavior occurs all over the country, and it occurs much, much more frequently than any of you in this room believe, and it occurs much more frequently than even I wanted to admit, and I've worked in this field for a long time. The amount of it would sicken me, and it would sicken all of us if we really knew how much of it there was. It's hard to come down with specific numbers, facts, and figures, but there are foundations, universities, the FBI, law enforcement people who have done surveys, extrapolated back, made estimates, blah, blah. Whether they're accurate, you know, your guess is as good as mine. The most recent study indicates, and it was based on an anonymous survey in several major cities, that one out of every four female children is sexually abused by the time she reaches the age of 18, either by someone in the family or by a stranger. And one out of every 10 males is sexually abused by the time he reaches 18. So if you look at, you know, assuming that's even in the ballpark, 25% of our youngsters running around on that playground out there are the victims of some kind of sexual abuse. That could be a one-time thing, or it could be a continuing subjugation that takes place over a period of years and is increasing severity as the child gets older.
And this includes any sort of sexual
that's
abuse,
right?
From
touching of the genitals to actual full-fledged intercourse. That's right.
And so what percentage would you think of the domestic child abuse that takes place is sexually related? Based
that's
on your experience,
say.
Would you say 20%, 50%?
Not that high, not 50%. You get allegations of child abuse if the child is neglected, not fed well, burned, and they don't know where the burn came from. You know, there's anything that's suspect supposedly is reported, which is good. I'm glad of that. I would say of reported cases, this is just a guess, sir, but I'd say 25% are child abuse.
Thank you. What steps are currently being taken by the department to increase response to this problem?
Okay. Actually, I'm real glad you asked that question because I feel like we can shine here. Up until probably about 2 years ago, sexual abuse within the family was considered to be a, quote, family problem. And those cases, when the social workers became aware of them, number one, and when they were willing to believe the child, number two, because there was a sort of a philosophy in mental health that this was sort of an Oedipus complex and the kid was making it up because they saw something on TV. I mean, there was a lot of denial by adults in responsible positions, not only in Alaska, but statewide. But once you got, one, a report, two, belief by the social worker, then you have, three, a question of treatment. And social workers, by their very mandate, by their nature, by their training, want to assist everybody involved in a situation, and therefore they're concerned with the offender and the family unit as well as the victim. And I don't mean to indicate that that's wrong, but that's where they're coming from. In the past, when these kind of cases were reported to social services, and you know you're only getting a tip of the iceberg there, they were virtually never reported to police, only in real, real bad situations where you have serious physical injury or venereal disease or something of that sort would it ever be reported to police. About two, maybe 3 years ago now, the prosecution function began to get involved in Fairbanks and Anchorage at first and then elsewhere statewide with attempting to get from social services a report of suspected child abuse, specifically sexual abuse. We don't necessarily want to be called every time a child is slapped, but we want to know if it looks like that child being sexually abused in his or her home, or the babysitter, or the uncle, or whoever. The social services varies a little bit from area to area, but on the whole was extremely cooperative with us, and in fact welcomed investigation by the police, because they were at the point of throwing their hands up on these cases, because the offender wouldn't cooperate. There was really no way to force him to cooperate. The only sort of act they had over his head was to take the child out of the home. So what happens? The child's victimized, and then who's punished? The child. The child's yanked out of the home. And mom and dad and all the siblings continue to lead their merry life. And they wanted a way to have a hammer over the defendant, the offender, to say, listen, you cut it out, or else. And that turned out to be the hammer of criminal prosecution or a possible jail sentence. So voluntarily, it started with reports to us, the Department of Law and the police, and we began to investigate these cases as the kind of case they are, which is a serious felony criminal offense. Last session, there was, you may be aware of this, other committee members may be aware, there was a reporting law passed which amended the child welfare statutes requiring reporting by social services to the police if, in fact, suspected child abuse was found. And that, so far as I know, has been working very well. We tell them, if we find out, we being the police, they tell us if they find out. And there are reports that go back and forth, and there are limits, you know, you have to get a report within 72 hours of receiving it, and that kind of thing. And it certainly increased the workload, but I think in terms of allowing us to address children in need, children who are being victimized in their own families, we're about 300% better today than we were 2 years ago, or 2 years ago.
And finally, so that we don't take up any more time, does your budget for fiscal 84 cover, in your opinion, the scope of the work that has to be done on this?
Are you talking about sexual abuse now? Because we really want to confine our comments to that.
Yes, I am. I'm talking about, yes, sexual abuse of minors, but my understanding is that it's the same basic group of individuals who have to enter the home, and so I'm sort of lumping it together.
That's kind of a hard question to answer. You never have enough people. I mean, you're always overworked, at least in the prosecution end. That's always been my perception. We work hard and we work long hours. We are handling the caseload now. There's a special sex offender unit in Anchorage that's set up that has two attorneys, and maybe we're going to put in three right now. They're handling child sexual abuse as well as adult rape. I think we could use more attorneys, but I think that this bill in particular, to follow Madam's advice to confine to this bill is not going to really raise our workload any, because what it's going to do is just raise the C felony to a B, and we're already prosecuting those people when we find out about them. So you're not really going to be added to your expense. And if I could just say one other thing, this is in response to what Mr. Pessinger said. He said in most cases this is not a family problem, and I'm sure that, you know, he looked at statistics to base that on. In fact, my experience is somewhat different, and all of the cases that I filed in Anchorage when I was doing child sexual abuse there, somewhat over 50% of those cases were intrafamilial. So if you're asking me to estimate the proportion in the state of Alaska, I would say you have a more higher incidence of family than you do of strangers. It's not, you know, I mean, you really don't have that much of a guy walking up in the playground and luring a kid away with candy. I mean, certainly it happens, but it's much more likely that that child being victimized by an uncle or a babysitter or a father, because they have access to the child.
Thank you very much.
We are now linked up to Anchorage, and if everybody will press their
just one.
Just one?
Okay, that's in time.
Just one. Representative Pessinger asked to return to the chair of the meeting.
Actually, I just wanted to ask the witness a question, if I could, Madam Chairman.
Oh, please.
I thought Representative Copeland made an important point that wasn't addressed, where you were concerned, Representative, that if the class was raised from a C
Excuse
to
me,
a
Sam,
B...
Excuse me, Sam. Could you come up there and depress that so that the people in Anchorage can hear you?
Representative Copeland raised an important point that I did not hear it be addressed. He was concerned that if it was raised from a Class C felony to a Class B felony, that this could deter prosecutors from handling the case because they might think that a jury might be more hesitant not to bring in a conviction on a more serious offense. And I was going to ask the witness to respond to that for him.
Would you just press that and push
sure.
it down as you...
I may have misunderstood your question, sir. If I did, I apologize. There are two answers to the question which I heard the representative raise. One is that in the state of Alaska, sentencing is done by statute by the judge, and the jury, in fact, is not ever told throughout the entire course of the trial what the sentence that the person is liable for is going to be. They're told it's a Class B felony, or unless you know what a Class B felony means, you don't know, other than it's a serious offense, you don't know, I don't believe the average citizen knows, what the possible sentences are. I would just note for the committee's information that the B felony does not carry a presumptive term on the first offense, nor does the C. It is the A felony which carries the presumptive term the first time around, and that gets back to the representative's concern about not doing a presumptive for family offenses. By the way, I agree with that. And that's why raising it to be would not prevent that problem.
Thank you. Chairman Tischer, speaking to those who have just joined us, I'd like to have you know that Representatives Gall, Representative Kopanen, Representative Davis, and Miller are present at this time. Representative Cato left because she was ill, and Representative Frist will be back. He has a testimony to give in another committee, but he will be back shortly. We have heard from the Municipal Prosecutor's Office, from the State Prosecutor's Office, and we have heard from the sponsor of the bill, Representative Sam Pessinger, and we now would ask that Scott Seidel, is that Seidel or Seidel? Seidel from the Municipal Prosecutor's Office join us, and please give your name and your office, if you would, and we'll listen to your testimony, and then we will ask the committee if they have any questions of you, if you'll stay online for that.
Hey, my name's Scott Seidel. I'm with the Municipal Prosecutor in Anchorage. I think I was asked here to answer questions and comment on House Bill number 128. I don't really have anything to that's been said on 117 and 127.
In that case, Mr. Seidel, if you would stand by, we are still discussing 117, and as soon as we finish with that, we can go on to 127 and 128, if you will stand by, please. Are there any more questions or comments or testimony to be received on House Bill 117? In that case, we'll set it aside for continued hearing, perhaps at a later date, we get fiscal note and perhaps a position paper. And we'll go on to House Bill 127. Mr. Davis, are you going to be discussing 127? We have
just a comment on 117. I was wondering if Gail could prepare some language change that she talking about for the committee.
I think that the committee staff has already got that down, but thank you. On to House Bill 127. The sponsor, Representative Lindauer, is present, and we would ask him to come forward then. But if we could, if staff has one more thing to tell us about this, anything about 127?
In your packet, there's a chart that I mentioned earlier, and I wrote in there in red 12 years underneath the 10 and 10 years underneath the age. Those are the changes that are proposed by this bill to the presumptive sentence for sexual assault in the first degree.
In that case, Representative Lindar, would you like to introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony?
Yes. Madam Chairman, I'm John Lindar.
Would you press the button?
Or just slide, you can slide the switch. There you go.
Madam Chairman, I'm John Lindar, representative from Anchorage. I'm here as the author of House Bill 127. I'll make my statements very short so we can get to House Bill 128, where the witnesses are waiting to testify. House Bill 127 is an effort to keep rapists off the street. It very simply increases the penalties for first-degree sexual assault, and that is rape, attempted rape, causing of injuries, and sexual activities with children under 13. No way it attempts to define who these people are. It merely says if you're convicted of first-degree rape, you will go to the slammer and stay there for a while, and I'd like to raise the penalty. I think we have too much rape, sexual assault.
Are there any questions of the committee? Are there any questions from the listeners or observers in Anchorage that would like to ask Representative Lindauer any questions while he is testifying?
There are no questions at this time, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you very much, Representative Lindauer. Are there any other witnesses here for 127? I believe we have two witnesses then in Anchorage. Mr. Scott Seidel, who was at the microphone a little bit ago from the Municipal Prosecutor's Office. We'd like to hear from you now, sir.
My name is Scott Seidel, and I work for the Municipal Prosecutor's Office here in Anchorage. As a Municipal Prosecutor, I don't come in contact very much with the actual offenses being discussed in this bill, the actual procuring of child prostitution itself, because that is a felony, and our office handles only municipal violations of municipal ordinances, which are all misdemeanors. But the prostitution offenses themselves, soliciting and loitering for prostitution, and the acts itself are violations of municipal ordinances. I'm the new kid on the block at the prosecutor's office, and as a result, I end up doing a lot of the pretrial work, the arraignments and bail hearings. And as a result, I probably actually see more of the women who are working in this profession in Anchorage than do the other attorneys. Very few of these cases are actually brought to trial from our office. What usually happens is the women plead not guilty at arraignment. They usually get a public defender, and either the case is dismissed if it looks like it would be very difficult to prosecute, and many of these cases are difficult to prosecute. Or in the alternative, the women usually change their plea to guilty. They cop a plea, and some sort of arrangement is worked out. So I've seen many of the women who work in prostitution in the city of Anchorage in court. And my observations, I am most shocked by how young many of the women look. That's my observation. Now, the women who are actually in court, who are actually being arraigned in district court, are women whose date of birth in the records we have indicate that they are not children, as I believe is defined by this act. Now, in the last couple of days, I've been doing some investigating and I've tried to determine how the criminal records system actually gets those dates of birth for women who are coming from out of the state and who have no criminal records in Alaska. Now, maybe I wasn't able to get a definitive answer, but the impression that I got from talking to the state troopers, talking to people in our office, talking to people over at the criminal division, is that someone who has no record whatsoever, who comes up here, who doesn't have an Alaska driver's license, which indicates exactly her date of birth, could end up giving a date of birth to the arresting officer or the officer that stops them the first time they come in contact with the system. They could give a date which is a few years older than they actually are, and there may be no way to check that. Now, this is hearsay. This is what I've been told from questioning around here, but I believe that's the case. Many of the young women that I saw who were supposed to be 21 and 22 years old, I just couldn't believe that was the case. They looked, despite their attempts to look old enough to be in the business, they certainly didn't look it to me. Many of them were pregnant. Many of them were out on the street 7 and 8 months pregnant, and then in jail in the same condition. And the most I can share with you are my own observations that I can't really say that I have come into contact with a girl under the age of 16, I believe is the cutoff. Yes, 16, who is actually working as a prostitute in the municipality of Anchorage, but I think that's very likely. And I think it's very likely that the young women that I saw may actually be underage or may be just over this age or a couple of years old. Certainly they look young enough. And it's very disturbing to me. The women who are working in the prostitution business in Anchorage are generally themselves victims, in my opinion. I think they're dominated by these men, the pimps, the ones who are promoting them. They're usually kept in houses that are rented or owned by these men, and their food, their clothing, their shelter is taken care of, but their freedom is nil. I think the vulnerability of young girls to this kind of domination, especially young girls who are runaways and have not had the kind of support in their own home, who haven't had someone that they think they can trust and believe in, and often they can find this in this person who stops them on the street and offers them the kind of shelter and help that they haven't perhaps seen. That girls this age are very vulnerable to that kind of thing. And once they get involved in it, it's very difficult for them to leave. They get involved in it here, and the pimps and the procurers in Anchorage are part of a network that connects to Hawaii, to San Francisco, to Seattle, and Southern California. And many of these women, when they end up getting in trouble in Anchorage, to the point where it's difficult for them to keep on with the business, then they end up being shuffled to Honolulu and then to Seattle, back up to Seattle. They leave when it's difficult here, when the crackdowns take place, so similar to the crackdown that's been taking place in Anchorage in the last couple of weeks, and then they come back. So I think that the changes in House Bill 128 are quite inappropriate. I think that defining the promoting of child prostitution as a Class A felony is a situation in which the punishment surely fits the crime. And I would definitely support this bill and amendment to AS 1166-110.
Thank you very much, Mr. Seidel. I'm sorry that I didn't indicate earlier that we were either going to be talking on House Bill 127 or 128, or maybe I was misunderstood. But we will take your testimony for 128, even though we were going to start out by talking about House Bill 127 that doesn't deal with prostitution. Your information.
Well, I'm sorry. I was under the impression we'd moved on to 128.
That's perfectly all right. We will accept your...
I had no comments on 127. I'm sorry I misunderstood. I've been rambling here on the wrong bill.
No, not at all. It probably was my error. I didn't make it more clear. We appreciate it. And since you have brought the subject up, I think we'll just stay on 128 until we receive all the testimony for that bill. And then we'll revert back to 127. We have on a list, Anchorage, another individual, Jody Engelman from McLaughlin Youth Center, that is on our list, but I'm not sure which bill that individual wishes to testify on. Could you inform me on that, please?
Yes, this is Jody Engelman. I wish to testify on House Bill 128. I'm the Director of Girls Detention at McLaughlin Youth Center, so I see often the young women that are involved in child prostitution. We have approximately 300 admissions a year in girls' detention, and about 50% of those admissions are involved in some form of prostitution. Now, many of those girls, I would have to estimate it, about 50% of those girls are probably under the age of 16, and we see very many girls involved in prostitution. Although I'm addressing girls in prostitution at this time, I want to make it clear that this is not a problem limited to females only. At McLaughlin, we see many young men who are also involved in prostitution at under the age of 16. Often they are charged with crimes other than prostitution, sometimes disorderly conduct very often, probation violations most often, but given the situation, the economic situation of young kids on the street, that seems to be one of the major ways that one can support oneself. It has been estimated that young women on the street more than a month are going to be involved in prostitution, and possibly 3 or 4 months for young men. It is the easiest way and the most effective way to find a place to live and food, and those are the primary motives. The pimps involved, I guess I should say, I just don't have much nice to say about them. The pimps involved prey on these young women and young men, whether they are 14, 12, and sometimes even younger. I would like to see this bill passed. I would like to see it a Class A felony, and I would like to see more attention given to prosecution and consequences to the pimps involved.
Thank you.
My testimony.
Thank you, Jody. I have a question that you might be able to answer. Of the clientele in McLaughlin, both boys and girls, could you give me an estimate of how many of those inmates are there because of their preoccupation with prostitution?
That's a difficult question in that, although the involvement is there, it isn't a direct cause of why they're there. It seems to be a way to support themselves while they're on the run, doing some other kinds of things. They're not charged directly with prostitution in most cases. Only very few cases are the kids charged essentially with prostitution.
Jody, could you tell me why that is? Are they in there for stealing or for some other offense then that is a result of lack of funds that has already led them into prostitution? Or what is it that you're trying to say?
Essentially, what you're saying is correct. The kids have left home for a variety of reasons, are involved in other things, other crimes, but also are involved in prostitution.
Thank you. I'm going to ask the members of this committee if they have any questions of you, Jody. Members, do you have any questions of Lady McLaughlin? Thank you very much, Jody. There seems to be no question. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Are there any other individuals here that would like to testify? I know that Gail perhaps has some information. Gail has some testimony, and also Mr. Lindahl, would you like to come and testify since you were introducing your house to 127? Would you please come back and...
Will be on 127 or 128?
We'll stay on 128 until we're finished with that.
Okay.
I apologize for the mix-up. Your introduction was on 127. So could we have you back for that? 128 now. We're on 128. We're going to stay on 128 until we finish it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm John Lindauer, and I testify in favor of the passage of 128. What this bill does is try to make it too expensive, too costly to engage in a business of child prostitution. The fact of life is that Alaska, and particularly Anchorage, has a major problem with child prostitution. The numbers that you just heard, approximately 50% of the children that are in the home have engaged in prostitution. The other evening we attended the Alaska Children's Services and we heard some of the stories, testimony of the very, very young prostitutes. It isn't so much the prostitutes that concern me in the sense that I think we can rehabilitate them once we get them into these homes. What I want to do, what I'm trying to do with this bill, is put the business people out of business by making the cost of doing business so high. It's a business. It's not an emotional crime in these attempts. Right now, they get the same penalties, that is to say very little, whether they're running adult women or whether they're running a 12 or 13-year-old. There's no difference in the penalty. And what I propose is to raise the penalty very substantially for children under 16. So that when it comes to making a decision of who you're going to be pimping for, they will not find it financially rewarding when they consider the length of time they're going to spend, the hard labor or wherever else in the equipment, to engage in this business. I strongly urge you to consider this bill. I think it addresses a problem which is very, very substantial in Alaska. And we just need to take these people who are exploiting these children, put them away for a very, very long time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lindauer. Would you please stay there until I ask the Anchorage office whether or not there are someone who might like to ask you questions? Anchorage, are there people there that would like to ask Representative Lindauer any questions on House Bill 128?
Oh, this is Scott Seidel again from the Municipal Prosecutor's Office. I don't really have a question there, but I would like to mention, although I do support this bill and I think that it's a positive act, I think I really don't believe that this is going to put anyone out of the business of child prostitution. As you're probably aware, prosecutions of prostitution itself are fairly easy. Prosecutions of the pimps themselves is very difficult. I think here in Anchorage, I was told by the vice cops at APD that they end up prosecuting about one a year is the average. And even that is very, very difficult. In order to get evidence of this kind of activity, you need to get that evidence from the prostitutes themselves. And that's a very dangerous step for them even to take. If they want to get out of the business, it's even difficult for them to get out of the business by leaving town at all. But for them to get out of the business by testifying and going to the police about their procurers and helping those police actually put together the evidence necessary for conviction of this kind of offense is very, very difficult. And while I think that if someone were to be convicted of the offense, the penalty here now befits it, I think we shouldn't delude ourselves into thinking that this is going to be in any way a solution. The problems of prosecuting this kind of activity, the procuring itself, is not, I don't believe, really going to be changed by this, except it's going to, if we, well, actually, if the APD and then the state district attorney actually ends up getting conviction of any of these people, they'll be able to go away for a longer period of time, which I think is valuable in and of itself. That's all I had to add to that.
Thank you very much, Scott. Are there any other people in Anchorage that would like to address the question to Representative Lindauer?
No, Madam Chairman, not at this time.
Thank you, Barbara. And thank you, Representative Lindauer. Do you have any more comments that you'd like to make, or are there questions of the committee to Mr. Lindauer? Thank you. Gail, would you like to return to the witness box there and introduce yourself all over again and make your comments?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Gail Zalewski. I don't need to spell it again, do I?
No, you don't need to.
I find myself in a position of agreeing with just about everything that, virtually everything that's been said by the other witnesses this morning, so I certainly not going to go on at length. I agree, unfortunately, with Mr. Seidel that although this bill is a good move, and I would strongly support it, it's strongly supported by the Department of Law, unfortunately, he's right, it's not going to solve the problem. His estimate of about one a year, based on my experience in Anchorage, for a number of prosecutions of pimps running child prostitutes is high. I was there for 4 years, and I only know of one case, and there may have been maybe one other, and I think there's one pending right now. The problems Mr. Seidel very accurately described to the committee, the girls are young, they're frightened, they often have been convicted of other offenses, stealing, other prostitution offenses. They, if they do go to the police, are intimidated out of continuing to testify by actual threats, beating, whatever you want to imagine that goes on in the same kind of mob situation happens, believe it or not, with these young kids on the streets of Anchorage. And the one trial that I'm aware of that happened in our office while I was there, the girls had a great deal of courage. We were able to get a warrant to actually tape some conversations with the pimp and use that as evidence. And despite the evidence we had, the jury had a hard time convicting that man. And I think that part of the difficulty is when normal people have to base, normal people, average citizens have to base a verdict on the testimony of two or three young girls, if they know, in fact, that the girls steal and use dope and run away and have they committed prostitution, then they begin to think, well, is this girl telling the truth? In fact, she may be, but they're not used to 15-year-old girls that do heroin and sell their bodies on the street. It's just not something a normal person runs into. I think it's a good bill. I don't think it's going to solve the problem. I certainly think the penalties are appropriate. And one nice thing about it is that because it's an A felony, it carries a presumptive 5-year sentence. So automatically, unless the court finds mitigating factors, the guy goes away for 5 years, and that's real nice. That's not a day less than what he deserves. Final comment is I would echo and agree strongly with the remarks from the lady from McLaughlin that I would have thought maybe it was even higher than 50% of the people that come through there are involved with prostitution, boys and girls. And I'd just like to add another remark going back to the bill we were discussing earlier, 117. In fact, a very, very large percentage of people who are involved in juvenile delinquency in committing all sorts of crimes, and specifically in prostitution, have been abused as children in their own homes. So you're seeing the result of child abuse when you see the kids get a little older and then they get involved in prostitution on the street.
I have a question, if I could ask Gail. In your experience in the Anchorage area, can you give me some idea of where these children come from, the prostitutes? Are they from local families? Are they white slavery? Are they from different towns in Alaska? What kind of people are we looking at? Are they?
Actually, Mr. Seidel is probably more qualified to answer that question. my impression is that they're largely white middle-class kids who have been abused at home, sexually abused at home, or physically abused, and they run away from home, and they find real quickly on the street that they have no food and no place to sleep, and the only person that befriends them is this pimp who, you know, sees them walking around and comes up to them. There are, you know, a certain number of black and native children as well, but at least based on the cases I've seen, they tend to be from white middle-class homes. Maybe his experience is somewhat different.
I meant to find out what location, what geographic location they were coming from the race, from the community that they're prostituting in, or from out of town, or out
I would
of
say
state.
Both. I would say the majority of them who start out in Anchorage are from Anchorage, or, you know, outlying areas, and they hitch into town, Palmer, the Valley. Or
thank you, Gail. Are there any questions of the committee? Gail, would you stay where you're at?
Oh, sure.
Sorry. Folks have a question to ask. Mr. Gallin and then Mr. Kopanen.
Thank you very much. Let me defer to Mr. Kopanen, if I may.
Mr. Kopanen, would you please depress your little button there so you...
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. I wondered if there was any recommendations that you might have to make this legislation more effective, perhaps not in regard to the legislation itself, but auxiliary legislation or whatever may be of help in obtaining investigation and prosecution and conviction. These people, or alternatively, how to deal with these migrants and with these loneliness?
If I had some suggestions about that, I probably would have made them a long time ago, either to this committee or to somebody else. We do have laws in the state against intimidating witnesses, obviously, and if we find out about it, we prosecute, and we have obtained convictions for intimidation of witnesses. But it's an awful hard thing to prove. The girls are actually in physical danger. It's not in their mind. You know, they actually are in physical danger. And for me as a prosecutor sitting in my comfortable little office and saying, well, don't worry about that, I can't do it. And I also am not usually in a position to provide 24-hour police protection. So they really are kind of on their own. We, you know, obviously we cooperate as much as we can. I don't know what else I can say. They're difficult problems because of the credibility of the witnesses, because of the kind of underworld type atmosphere those kids move in, and you sort of have the honor among thieves thing that they are rejected by other people when the other people find out, the other people in their sort of social group on the street finds out that they've gone to the police. You know, they're seen as snitches and they can't be trusted. And
perhaps some sort of witness protection program?
I really don't know, sir. I guess if I could maybe think about that and get back to you. Off the top of my head, I can't think of anything else we could do other than provide increased police protection. And that might be in the guise of increasing police resources. Often when I go to a police sergeant or a police captain and say, listen, you know, I need some protection for somebody, well, they tell me quite truthfully, I don't have anybody to give you. And I know they're telling me the truth on that. You know, they're strained as well. So other than, you know, just a general increase of those resources, I don't have any specific suggestions. I wish I did.
Mr. Gall?
Sometimes these problems of getting adequate testimony of itself, for example, in the drug or controlled substances area by using informants, making buys, if you will, in the street.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do this in the prostitution area, too? In other words, if you have a problem getting the woman to testify against the procurer, are you in a position to put a man out on the street and have him try to obtain the services of a young woman and then arrest the person who procures those services?
We can do that, sir. I don't know that we've specifically done that in any case that I'm aware of in the past. You have to understand that if it's an adult, it's a misdemeanor only. So that's the municipal prosecutor in Anchorage, at least, that would handle those. If we're talking only about a child thing, certainly it would be possible to set up something like that but I'm not sure exactly in what situation it would work. If the girl has come to you and said, I'm a prostitute, this guy's my pimp, if you have an officer, usually the pimps are not involved directly in procuring. I mean, the girls that stand on the street corner and the pimps just take the money. For an officer, for example, to go up to the girl and say, will you come with me to the room? And she goes, sure. All that does is implicate her. It doesn't do anything about the pimp. So the only thing really that we can do in terms of getting real solid admissible evidence is the one example I used. In some circumstances, if you know ahead of time that the girl is going to meet the pimp in a given hotel room or street corner or something, and she's got the courage to do it, we can put a wire on her and try to record some incriminating comments that way. And that has had success in that one case that I mentioned.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Steve. Are there any other witnesses for House Bill 128? Are there any comments or questions from the committee on 128? Is there anyone in Anchorage now that wishes now to testify or make comments on House Bill 128?
Madam Chairman, we have no one in Anchorage who wishes to speak.
Thank you. In that case, we will postpone it or continue discussions on this bill when we receive the fiscal note and perhaps the paper from. Let's go on now to House Bill 127, which deals with an act to increase the punishment for sexual assault in the first degree. For the purpose of recollection, if Mr. Lindauer would like to repeat his testimony for this, we'd welcome him to come back, if you'd like to, Representative Lindauer, as sponsor of this bill. If you feel as though we've got it, well, I will. We'll go from here. All right, thank you very much. For those folks in Anchorage, can you tell me whether or not there's anyone in Anchorage that would like to testify on behalf of House Bill 127?
There is no one here to testify on House Bill 127, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Barbara. Is there anyone here that would like to speak on that subject? In that case, perhaps we can ask Gail to return from the prosecutor's office and give us some testimony to the sexual assault in first degree issue.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Again, for the record, my name is Gail Horesky. I'm with the Criminal Division of the State Department of Law, and addressing specifically House Bill 127, which increases the presumptive terms for sexual assault. After careful reflection and discussion with several members of the department, internally, we have decided that we do not, in fact, support this bill. And if you'll bear with me, I'd like to explain the reasons why. On the face, it seems a kind of an odd stance for the prosecutor's office to take. And we certainly are not in any way, shape, or form denigrating the seriousness of sexual assault in the state of Alaska. It's a serious problem. We're among the highest states in the nation in terms of the rate of violent sexual assaults against the women. I personally feel very strongly about it, and I know that the other people in the department do as well. Setting aside, though, that sort of gut-level feeling about it, and looking at this legislation objectively as to whether or not it adds affirmatively anything to our statute, our decision was, in fact, we believe it does not. To understand our position, it's important to look at the criminal code in the state of Alaska as a comprehensive, cohesive whole. I'm sure all of you are aware that in 1978, the new criminal code was adopted, and it took effect, of course, January 1, 1980. The entire point of all of that work and agony and committee substitutes and finally coming up with a repeal of all the existing criminal laws and substitution of the criminal code was to put some kind of consistency and sense into the relative penalty scheme for various offenses. Under the old code, you had very, very anomalous situations where somebody would come up with a more
serious sentence for certain types of property offenses that he or she would be eligible for serious offenses against persons. And that's because the code in Alaska and in most states had been adopted piecemeal year after year, and one person would feel strongly about one thing and they'd stick it in, and there wouldn't be a reflection back of how does this fit into murder versus arson versus prostitution. The code was an attempt to, as I said, put some kind of consistency in the sentencing scheme and to punish serious things seriously and to not have such serious penalties for more minor offenses, mainly property offenses. With that background, I'd like to point out to you that right now, sexual assault in the first degree is one of the three unclassified crimes in the state of Alaska. Murder, kidnapping, sexual assault, one. That was an increase from first degree sexual assault and a felony last term. And we were in favor of that. We supported it, and we think that that was a good move. Absolutely no problems with that. So the current penalties under the law for sexual assault in the first degree are 30 years, up to 30 years in prison, with a presumptive term of 8 years. I have a problem with that presumptive term as it relates to child offenses, certain child offenses, specifically intrafamilial ones. I won't really address that now. We talked about that earlier when we talked about child offenses. But what you have to understand is right now the penalties for sexual assault in this state are higher than for any other offense other than first-degree murder or kidnapping. And that's as it should be. No problem with that. But this raising of the presumptive terms, in the opinion of the Department of Law, doesn't really add anything in the sense of deterrent value and throws the code more out of skew with the relative classification system which the entire code was intended to set up. For example, under this provision, if a person is convicted of an A felony, he or she is subject to a presumptive term of 5 years. This is already a presumptive term of 8 years. We're 3 years higher than armed robbery, for example, serious assault where there's serious physical injury, somebody's got their eye put out, somebody's stabbed, something like that. You're already 3 years above that in terms of your presumptive level. Right now, under second-degree murder, kidnapping, and misconduct involving controlled substance in the first degree, that's like furnishing heroin to a minor, that sort of thing, there isn't even a presumptive term. There's a mandatory minimum of 5 years. So you have to be careful here. What you're getting yourself in a position of is punishing more severely sexual assault with an 8-year presumptive than you are punishing murder in the second degree or manslaughter. And as I say, I don't have any quarrel with the current provision. But if you kick them up much higher, you have to think, and this even sends chills down my spine to suggest it, but are you setting up a situation where it's to a kidnapper or a rapist's advantage to kill his victim? Because ironically enough, he is subject to lesser penalties for murder than he would be for sexual assault. Now, obviously, murder in the first degree carries a mandatory minimum of 20, so if you could prove that it was first degree, you wouldn't have that argument. But obviously, if he kills his victim, it's that much harder to prove, number one, who did it, and number two, what the circumstances of the killing were. And as far as I'm concerned, our ultimate goal should always be the protection of the victim as well as the punishment of the offender. And although I certainly support stiff penalties for sexual assault, I do not want to get ourselves in a position, just because we didn't think about it, of in effect rewarding somebody for killing his victim. And again, it's just to suggest it, I shivered down, but I don't think we can ignore that possibility. The other thing is that 8 years right now is the presumptive term. If there are aggravating factors which the court can find, such as injury on top of the rape to the victim, or the fact that he broke into her house to commit the crime, or anything of that sort, that he raped her more than once, the court is free to raise the presumptive level to the max, which is 30. So you could certainly get a 10 or 15 year sentence for a first offense sexual assault if the facts warrant it. The judge is also free to reduce the presumptive term by up to 50% of the maximum. So that would be, in the current case, down to 4 years. I wouldn't, again, want to set up a position where you're not talking about a jury, because they don't know the penalty usually, but you're talking about a judge, where you have a sentencing judge who, although he knows the man is guilty and although he knows the man deserves jail time, feels that, for example, a 12-year presumptive or a 10-year presumptive might be too high. You're going to set up a situation where the judge is going to be more tempted to find the existence of mitigating factors and lower it down. And you might end up with a situation where a guy would get a lower sentence under the 12-year presumptive because the court kicks it back down than you would if the court, you know, if you just left it with the 8-year and the court went with the prison term and just said, well, it seems a little tough, but the legislature has spoken, and I'll go with it. I'm not saying that this would automatically happen, but as soon as you start to get penalties that appear to a sentencing judge to be out of proportion to the individual offense or the offender, then you have that temptation of, what can I do to adjust this? Well, I'll just find mitigating factors and I'll drop that back down. And I just don't think that's appropriate, as long as the sentence is fair to the judge. If there are any questions, I'd certainly be glad to address them.
Are there any questions of the committee?
Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you, Gail. Would you hold on just a minute until I ask Anchorage if there is someone there that would like to ask Gail any questions on this?
No, Madam Chairman, there are no questions.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you very much, Gail.
Thank you.
Are there any other people here that would like to testify on behalf of this bill? And if so, please come forth. Are there any more comments from the committee on this bill? Hearing none. Oh, Mr. Copeland.
Thank the chairman for having the witness. I'd like to thank Madam Chairman for having the witness from the state prosecutor's office. I think her testimony on all of these bills has been very illuminating and very helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Copeland. Any other comments or questions from the committee? Hearing none, then I'll adjourn this meeting and carry these over until next time, if we have a fiscal note, being adjourned.